This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Don Bentley, who has joined the small group of writers selected to continue writing about Jack Ryan and his son, Jack Ryan Jr., since the death of Tom Clancy in 2013. Tom Clancy published his first novel featuring Jack Ryan in 1984. In 2003, he introduced his son, Jack Ryan Jr. Don Bentley is the fifth writer selected to continue the series following Tom Clancy's death in 2013. Don Bentley spent a decade as an Army Apache helicopter pilot in Afghanistan and was awarded the Bronze Star Medal and an Air Medal with V device for valor. After retiring from the military, Don Bentley worked as an FBI special agent, focusing on foreign intelligence and counterintelligence, and was a SWAT team member. He's written two novels featuring Matt Drake, a former Ranger working for the Defense Intelligence Agency. Target Acquired is his first novel featuring Jack Ryan Jr. This is an excerpt from the audiobook, read by Scott Brick.
Jack Ryan Jr. took another bite of falafel, hunching his broad shoulders to protect his prize against the press of hundreds of bodies. At 6'2" and 220 pounds, Jack was a big man even by American standards. In Israel, he towered over most of the crowd. Even so, he still felt like a lion guarding its prey from a pack of circling wild dogs. Jack smiled at the image, expertly using a thick forearm to guide a chattering trio of teenagers away from his dripping food. Wild dogs on the savannah would try to rob the lion of his food, despite their small size. But the crowd that ebbed and flowed up the narrow confines of Hakarmel Street was absent the malicious intent of an African predator, regardless of how small. Over the last decade or so, Jack had become adept at reading crowds, and this one radiated benevolence. The Mediterranean sun shone from a sky the kind of perfect blue usually seen only in photoshopped travel brochures, bathing the crowd in soothing light. The air was warm without the stickiness of the hot season, while the faint smell of salt water blowing in from the ocean just blocks away mingled with spicy scents of food cooking in the countless booths lining the street. Jack caught bits and pieces of a handful of languages as vendors and potential buyers argued over prices and wares. Jack was no stranger to foreign locales, but there was something inherently magical about Tel Aviv. The city felt electric, full of entrepreneurs whose agile minds and unbounded dreams rivaled those of Silicon Valley. Here, in the Middle East's only democracy, the weather was excellent, the women beautiful, the people friendly, and the food fantastic. In short, the perfect vacation city. But Jack wasn't on vacation. As if on cue, a man settled into a plastic seat adjacent to a table at the opposite side of the alley. He was late 40s to early 50s, with a full head of blonde hair that was just beginning to gray at the temples. The man dusted off the table with the fastidious nature of someone unaccustomed to the grit and dirt common to open-air markets. Once he'd cleared the spot in front of him of all debris, real and imaginary, he flagged down a waiter. The proprietor came over with a smile, and the man ordered a coffee in English before adding the obligatory "Toda, thank you." The waiter smiled again before leaving to fetch the man's order. Just another foreigner in a diverse, multinational crowd. But to Jack's practiced eye, the man still seemed out of place. It wasn't so much his fair complexion in the sea of olive-toned skin or his attire. Though the majority of the shoppers were Israeli or Arab, plenty of Europeans mingled with the natives, and the man had done a fairly respectable job of incorporating local fashion. He wore a button-down shirt in the local style, open at the collar so that a tuft of chest hair poked through, and jeans and sensible shoes. No, it wasn't the man's wardrobe or genetics. His actions were the problem. Rather than the laissez-faire attitude coupled with liberal shoving that pervaded the rest of the afternoon shoppers, the man was clearly on edge. His head moved with sharp, bird-like movements as he looked from one end of the alley to the other, scrutinizing each passerby like he was a man on a mission. Which he was. But he was supposed to be behaving as if he wasn't. Popping the last bite of falafel into his mouth, Jack dusted off his hands and then slid his cell from his pocket. Opening the Notes app, Jack began to annotate his initial impressions. Tel Aviv was already one of his favorite cities, and while he'd like to do nothing more than go for a run along the beach and admire the local talent, that wasn't why he was here. Technically, espionage was a tricky business. Even with mind-numbing advances in technology, running an agent or asset was still a deeply personal endeavor. As such, much of it was based on impressions or gut feelings, and right now the man who'd just ordered a coffee was acting like he'd consumed far too much caffeine already.
Scott Brick, reading from the audiobook edition of Don Bentley's Search and Destroy, his first novel featuring Jack Ryan Jr., the character created by the late Tom Clancy. I asked him what attracted him to writing stories featuring a character created by another writer.
When I was 13 or 14 years old, my neighbor friend down the street gave me this dog-eared copy of a book called Red Storm Rising, and he said, "You have got to read this. Like, this is the most fascinating book I've ever read." And it was obviously by Tom Clancy, his epic military thriller, and it just was my gateway drug into this genre. And so I devoured Tom Clancy books from then till my adulthood, and so getting the opportunity to write in the Tom Clancy universe, the only thing as a writer, specifically, the only thing I think that is akin to that is if you're a screenplay writer and somebody says, "Hey, do you want to write the next Star Wars movie?" And so there's this tremendous kind of, especially for folks who are fans of this genre, to say, "Hey, man, you get to take the legacy that Tom built, this universe that he built, and you get to continue the story in some form or fashion." And so there's a tremendous draw there to be a part of that, to be a part of, you know, our version of the Star Wars universe and maybe to expand that legacy some way. And so that, you know, why did I want to draw it? Because I'm a huge Tom Clancy fan. He influenced me as a reader. And if you would have told 14-year-old me that 47-year-old me gets to write a Tom Clancy book, I wouldn't have believed you at the time. And frankly, I still don't believe half the time that I'm allowed to do this.
And he's a great character. Unlike Jack Ryan, he's not married, and he likes to have fun. While at the same time, he's a serious professional.
And he's interesting from another standpoint too, in that so his father, Jack Ryan Sr., was a CIA analyst before he got himself into trouble by helping a Russian submarine captain defect and stealing a nuclear submarine, as CIA analysts are wont to do from time to time. But like most protagonists in this space, he has a background that would give you the yes, he should do that. Or if you look at, you know, other story protagonists like Jack Reacher's Lee Child served in the Army, you know, Vince Flynn's Mitch Rapp was a CIA employee. Jack Ryan Jr. started out as a financial analyst who worked for this off-the-books firm called The Campus, and so he never went to the farm as a CIA case officer was. He wasn't from the special operations community. He didn't do it, and so he certainly had to earn his spurs, if you will, by doing that, but he doesn't have the typical background of a thriller writer protagonist, at least not originally. And you add to the fact that his, you know, all sons kind of grow up maybe living in the shadow of their fathers. His father has saved the world multiple times over and is now president. And so there's some really interesting dynamics and threads you can pull there where a guy knows that, frankly, Jack Ryan Jr. has the opportunity to work at the campus because his name is Jack Ryan, right? And he's his father's son. And so there's that dynamic of how does he prove to the people he works with that he's worthy to be there when he's the only guy who's not a paramilitary guy, who didn't come from the CIA, who wasn't a Delta Force operative. And so there's some really, really interesting dynamics that make him a very fun character to write.
It strikes me there's something of an interesting parallel between the character you've just been describing and yourself against Tom Clancy. Tom Clancy, you know, conceived this character and started writing these apparently deeply researched novels because he didn't have a military background, yep. Did he?
That's right. Nope, he was an insurance salesman. Insurance salesman with a library card.
Conversely, you come to it both as a clearly skilled writer. You've written a series of books before this, but even if this were your first book, just reading it, it's clear you're a writer. But at the same time,
you
have an extensive military background. You flew an Army Apache helicopter in Afghanistan, and I'm thinking, you know, I've been in a helicopter a few times, and a helicopter in a mountainous country, that must have been a bit of a challenge of a thing.
It was brutal. So, and that's a very insightful question. You're the first one who's asked me that. So we were the first Longbow Apache helicopters into Afghanistan. And the reason why that's important is the Longbow was the follow-on helicopter to the original Alpha model Apache. And it was significantly heavier and had the exact same engine. So very underpowered. Mm. And the mountains in the summertime in Afghanistan, most of the time there wasn't even enough power to hover. And so to take off, you'd literally bounce along the ground until you got to about 15 or 20 knots and the wind would clear the vortices out of the rotor blades. And hopefully that happened before you hit the retaining wall on the far side of the base. And so it was, you know, I tell people that I got shot at a couple times, and that was certainly an invigorating experience, but I was more terrified just flying day to day in the summertime because we did not lose any aircraft, any Apaches to enemy fire, but we lost two to pilots overflying their capabilities in the summertime. And so that absolutely was a terrifying thing. And to, you know, kind of tie that back into a writing perspective, because what you started with that question is also a very interesting one, and that folks think, you know, does your background help as a writer? Does that experience? And it does to a certain extent. You know, I was also an FBI special agent and a SWAT guy, and then got to work on the civilian side of things for the last 9 years or so, helping to market and develop technology for primarily customers in the special operations community. And so you get to meet a lot of really interesting people and take away some things that help with your writing. But I think a lot of the times that can be a blind spot, in that what happens is you think, you know, I've served or I've been in combat, I know how this should go. Whereas somebody like Tom Clancy, or frankly right now you have Daniel Silva or Brad Thor or Vince Flynn when he was still alive, none of those guys served. None of them were in the military, and they write fantastic books. And I think there's something to be said for approaching it cold slate the way Tom Clancy is, and say, I'm going to be an insurance salesman with a library card and learn everything there is to do about this and write these such compelling books that when he started writing them, people were convinced he somehow had access to classified material, versus coming in with that background, which is good, but maybe can make you have blinders on if you're not careful.
I'm with you. Yeah, I can see the advantage both of coming from the outside and also coming from the inside. But as you say, the challenge, it would seem to me, as a writer coming from the inside, is just how much you do know. And that is apparent throughout the book, that you write from a number of different perspectives, which is kind of interesting in itself. But there's always this sense that you are writing about, or you're writing from the perspective of somebody who's already experienced something similar to this. Aside from anything else, it was a revelation to me that Tel Aviv is a place that would be fun to go for on a vacation.
Tel Aviv is one of my favorite cities in the world. And so, in the last 9 years, I've worked with a number of Israeli companies because... So Tel Aviv is, first off, I'd say that Israelis are different, especially in when you talk about folks who work in the defense space, because unlike in America, where less than half of 1% of people have ever served in the military, in Israel, every do a tour of duty in the IDF or something similar once they graduate from high school. And so what that means is that if you work for Boeing and you're making an Apache helicopter and you're an engineer, chances are you've never served in the military, you've never flown an Apache, anything like that. In Israel, and you're an engineer working on a particular piece of technology, you have served. And so you might not have been a special operations person or an Apache pilot, but you certainly bring a perspective that most people don't. That's the first part. The second part is because Israel is you know, surrounded by folks who, for the most part, wish them ill will, they're able to develop technology very, very quickly because you're fielding something that is getting used and then you're getting feedback on it the next day. And so you have this very vibrant community in Tel Aviv from a startup perspective, and then also some very gifted engineers and scientists who work in the defense space as well. But Tel Aviv is a fantastic city. The Israelis are warm people. They speak good English for the most part. They like Americans. The food there is spectacular. The Tel Aviv itself, the beaches and things are amazing. And then the sense of history and stuff that's there. But it also, you know, in my book, the Iron Dome figures very, very prominently. And obviously never would I have predicted what's going on or what's going on right now with Hamas. But I actually had two of my Israeli coworkers who were in the States a couple weeks ago when everything was going down, and they're literally showing me videos that their son or daughter has taken standing on their front porch of rockets arcing over their head and the Iron Dome working to intercept them. And so it's such a crazy, crazy dynamic. There are two different things where the majority of time it's this incredible, vibrant city. It's kind of Tel Aviv. You know, there are a lot of comparisons to Manhattan, perhaps. And then on the other part of the time, you're still reminded that they're surrounded by enemies and have to figure out a way to live when they're faced with that threat.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's one of the reasons that I guess it was I can't think of a better word for the moment, but it's not quite a revelation, but it's not something that you necessarily think about. You know, Israel, sure, as you say, being sadly, you know, after all this time, still essentially a warrior state.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, it's a war zone, right? Okay. Tel Aviv is a war zone. And that comes through in the book, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It is right now. What I should say is thankfully there are large stretches of time where it's very much a peaceful city. You know, in the times that I visited, there was never anything like that. But one of the reasons why it is a peaceful city most of the time is because of the very aggressive intelligence services that Israel has. So the Mossad is the intelligence service that focuses primarily outside Israel's border, and then the Shin Bet, which is kind of their equivalent of the American FBI, that focuses on domestic security. And the Shin Bet plays very heavily in target acquired. And to me, it's fascinating because when I was an FBI agent, and I didn't work counterterrorism specifically, but the folks that did, it was often a long lead thing that you worked, right? So you're trying to figure out where the, you know, if there's a cell, where they came in, who the people are. And there's always a sense of urgency, don't get me wrong. But in Israel, it's completely different when the threat that you're working, you know, whether it's in the West Bank or the Gaza, literally abuts to the geographical, you know, it'd be like if they were in Mexico or Canada instead. Right. And so it brings a completely different sense of focus to the Shin Bet and to the Mossad and to the Israelis' intelligence services.
The impression I have from the book is that somebody who looks like an American stands out in Tel Aviv. There aren't that many. There aren't that many Western tourists in the city. Is that true? Do you think?
I think there's probably a fair amount there. Now, I think certainly the preponderance of them are folks who look Mediterranean for sure. But I think, you know, when you look on that thread that you're pulling a little bit is talking somewhat about the antagonist that I have in the book. And when I set out to create them, you think an intelligence service, even as one is capable as the Shin Bet, still has to prioritize efforts and targets, right? And so if the majority of your threat, if you think the majority of your threat comes from a person who looks a certain way or who fits a particular targeting package that you come up with. Well, if you don't look that way, you are maybe going to be missed, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, they're not supermen just like anybody else is, or superwomen. And so you have to prioritize your efforts based on what you think the threat is. And so if you're a bad guy and you can look like you're not part of that threat, well, then you already have a leg up.
Yes, and you do a very good job of creating a world that's so remarkably slippery. There doesn't seem to be, you know, to have a sense at any moment that you're sure of what's going on is probably an illusion.
Yep. Absolutely. And that's what I think folks, it's certainly a struggle as a writer, because what you want is something that is that is straightforward enough that the reader can follow along with what you're doing without getting overwhelmed. But to your point, in real life, things are complex. There are usually, it's not a black and white issue. It's not a single problem. There are layers upon layers, and something that you might do with the best of intentions has unforeseen repercussions. And so I did try and capture that and have layers, especially when I came into this book, since it was my first one in the Clancy universe, and I really wanted to write a stripped-down book just focusing on Jack Ryan Jr. as a character. And so when you do that and you have that much of a focus on a single character, there has to be enough complexity there to carry the novel. Otherwise, it becomes, you know, a very, not predictable, but just falls short of what Clancy readers expect. And so I certainly made things slippery, as you termed it. I like that.
You did. What's your background as a writer? When did you start writing? And did you go to school for that, like Clancy? Were you an English major too?
From being in grade school, I always liked to tell stories. And my senior year of high school, I had a great English teacher, my AP English teacher, who looked at one of the short stories I've written and kind of took me aside, and she said, "You can do this. Like, you have the gift for this. You should try and become a writer." And so I heeded her advice and majored in electrical engineering, as all good writers do in college. And as you can imagine, that was infinitely helpful to my writing career. But I did, in about 2000 or 2001, I started getting serious about being a writer. And so I knew that there were some foundational things that I didn't understand about my craft. And so at the time, Writer's Digest Online had some great classes that you could take that were kind of breaking down, here's the structure of a novel, here's the mechanics of a scene, here's how you do that. And so after doing that, I wrote my first book, which was good enough to get an agent, but not good enough to sell. And then I wrote a second book and had a similar thing. And then I thought, you know, maybe I need to still get better at my craft. So I went and got my MFA in writing popular fiction from a school called Seton Hill University. It's in Pennsylvania. And it is an unabashedly genre-focused MFA program. So it's for people who want to learn how to write commercial fiction. And so I wrote my third novel then as my thesis, and that didn't sell either. And then after an appropriate amount of sulking, I wrote my fourth novel, which did sell in a two-book deal. And so if you discount the 17 years between 2001, when I got serious, and 2018, when I sold my first two books, and the three novels that failed, I'm pretty much an overnight writing success.
Yeah, I love the notion of overnight success. It never happens, does it?
But never.
Congratulations and kudos to you for your fortitude, which, of course, as we were just saying, anybody who's flown a helicopter in Afghanistan, writing a novel, I mean, that's child's play compared to that. I'm wondering, you know,
wholeheartedly disagree.
as you, when you became an adult and you started having that kind of experience, how did that affect your impression of Clancy's novels? Did you still find them credible, even though you had inside information?
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about Tom Clancy, is his novels both stand the test of time and stand up to scrutiny. When I was in the military, he was wildly popular in the military, and it was not uncommon when you're traveling or on deployments and stuff to see people read Clancy books. And so there are still certainly aspects of it that he takes liberties with. But you know what? That's at the end of the day, you're not writing nonfiction. You're writing fiction. And I think the contract that Tom Clancy made with his readers is I'm going to get as many of the technical details right as I can to prove to you that I understand the world in which I'm writing. And then in exchange, you give me the ability to tell a great story, because those two things sometimes are in conflict. And I think he did that masterfully well.
Yeah, you're not writing a textbook. The first thing you have to do is tell a compelling story.
That's right. At the same time,
I have this sense reading your work that you understand how the intelligence community works. It's a bit like John le Carré, you know.
Sure.
It's not James Bond. While James Bond's enormously entertaining, if you really want to know what it's like to be in an intelligence service, le Carré is going to give you a much clearer picture of it, but again, I keep wanting to come back to how challenging that must be for you to know so much and yet still, okay, I've got to stay on the story here. Now the story's the most important thing, but I really think you should know this, because if you know this, then you'll understand better.
It's always the line that you walk in. And so one example I use in my Matt Drake series, my first book, Without Sanction. So Matt Drake, my protagonist, is a case officer, a member of the intelligence community for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And so there's a scene in that book where he needs to get into the country he's trying to infiltrate. And so he does what's called a hey-ho jump, a high altitude, high opening jump. And I've never done that before, but I have a friend, a very close friend, who was a member of Delta Force for a number of years. And so I had him read it. And I'm like, hey, here's what's going on. And read this and tell me if I got the details right. And he came back and he's like, yep, this is good. This is good. Change this. Do something different here. And he's like, you know, though, we would never just send one guy in, right? And I'm like, yeah, I know that. But was it a good story? And he said, it was a fantastic story. And I'm like, well, that's then I'm sending one guy in because it's a fantastic story. And so I think that's the constant, you know, what I kid with my wife all the time when she asks me about it. And I say, you know, I never let the truth stand in the way of a good story. And I think that's what you have to do, right, is show enough that the readers say, yep, this guy's done his homework and he knows what he's talking about. But at the end of the day, your job is still to tell a great story.
Search and Destroy is the first novel by Don Bentley, featuring the character Jack Ryan Jr., created by Tom Clancy. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots Talking Writing.